So I want to take the discussion in the direction of the Buddhist teachings and talk a little bit about empathy and what you'd call the participatory universe, a universe of participation and not separation, and explore a little bit some of the ethical implications, because the ethics is so much part of essential ground for our life together as beings sharing the same world. Whether we're Buddhist or we're not Buddhist, it's the ground of our relationship. So it needs to be brought in. I want to thank Yulia's presentation, because it does raise some very important issues that come into this. First of all, the fact that Yulia explored the mirroring, the fact that it's basic and unconscious, the fact that the mirroring is happening of whether we know it or we don't know it, is very important, because firstly, we have a kind of existential loneliness. We have existential isolation. We have a sense that we're locked into a self, and that all of us suffer because we're locked into a self that is busy with survival. And this kind of makes a lie out of this sense of isolation, that there are processes going on that we simply don't know them, that are interconnecting us all the time with the world, with each other, and that the construction of self, which seems to make us separate and often miserable, is a process that is around the forgetting or the blocking of interconnection. And there's an important shift in the view. If it's automatic going on all the time, that means when we don't know our interconnection, it's because we blocked it, or we forgot it, or we are too much in the use the psychological language of the sort of top level thinking, which somehow conceiving life there and we here. So it's important, and it opens up a direction, which is that if we want to reconnect ourselves with the world, then we already have the mechanisms, we just have to know them more and use them more and learn about them more. And that so invites us to practice meditative or contemplative practices that actually open and expand the tools that are on the automatic of the mirror neurons and all the networks that we have in the mind to connect, that connect ourselves to the other. We have here an invitation to expand a mechanism ready made to expand this interconnection by bringing those into awareness. So I want to talk a little bit about the role of mindfulness, the role of meditation, the role of Buddhist practice. But I must say first, I'm going to come back to this, that the Buddhist teaching takes all of this way, way, way into a radical place. In a radical place, which is that not only do we mirror each other, everything is mirroring everything else, and therefore there's no essential reality. That's where the Dharma takes it. There can be no reality if everything is mirroring everything else. There's no, should we say, observable fixed reality. Of course there's reality, but we cannot define reality because everything is reflecting everything. And the fundamental teaching, and I'll go back to this, of co-creation, of everything creating everything else, is a radical place where the Dharma goes and takes this very far. So when we have a sense that we want to explore meditation or inner work, we often feel that we want certain things out of this practice. We want calmness, for example. We want happiness. We want less suffering. We want less. We want to be wiser, clearer, higher. This voice is a voice of an individual. It's a voice of an individual saying, "I want certain extra properties, qualities, or experiences." So we have to remember that we often bring this individual voice to the Dharma practice, to the spiritual practice, and we practice mindfulness to have a better life. In this intention, not only mindfulness, we want to be wiser, so we read books. But we have the self has an ongoing discussion saying, "I want myself to be in a better place." Forgetting that there's an individual that says that. There is an individual that says, "I want for myself to be an individual." Much of the Dharma practice that's coming out of the East, by the way, came because of, and there's historical research about this, because of the Protestant individualism of the Western world coming to Burma and saying, "Let's meditate as individuals." Whereas a lot of Eastern Dharma Buddhist practice and Buddhist teaching is not about being an individual at all, and doesn't emphasize meditation as individual development. This in a way came from the West, brought meditation back to the West as a development of the individual. So we forget that we're in this, that mindfulness and meditation practice may be something that isn't that important for us as an individual, but for us as eyes of the world. And there's a beautiful Tibetan text saying, "We are the eyes of the world." What is an individual? We are looking, the world looking out of the eyes of this being, of this embodied person. The world is looking out at the world. Where's the self? Where's the individual? So there's a kind of, right at the beginning, we have to play with this issue. And anything we do to practice in some way is going to help us joining the world again and reducing the sense of being an isolated, separate self. So I want to just a little bit take a few minutes, Bersograim, and kind of take 5 minutes to give the talk about the fundamental Buddhist teaching in relational terms, in terms of relations, rather than in terms of many other ways that you can look at the Buddhist teaching. The Buddha said, "I'm here only to do one thing, which is teach about suffering and the ending of suffering." And suffering or non-satisfaction, isipuk, difficulties, stress, pain, is seen in the Buddhist teaching as the result of the withdrawal from the world, that we disconnect from the world, we get trapped in a habit of self-reference, of thinking of ourselves separate from the world, and then most of what we do in our life is about survival, is about resisting the world. This self that is withdrawn from the world then has a fight all its life to reduce change, to have less disease, not to die, to be comfortable. This withdrawal creates a struggle or a mismatch. The world is wild, unpredictable, take us to pieces, kill us, make us sick, make us hungry, make us needy, changing constantly, and the self wants the opposite. To be here tomorrow and not to die, to be comfortable, to resist the way the world wants to the farekotan, to be stable, to survive, and that creates a fundamental mismatch between the chaotic, changing, moving world of which we have no control, and the self that wants to control it. That is, in a nutshell, the nature of suffering. And the Buddha said, therefore, in this mismatch, ihatama, between a self that is busy trying to survive and the world, come back to the world. See that you are the world, that there's no mismatch anymore. And that's understanding that you are in constant relation, constant flow, that you yourself are the world, that you are part of the change. In you is change, in you is not a self, in you is piruk. You're also going to pieces like the world. So coming back into the world, and that's a sort of relational view of the basic Dharma teaching. And practice, mindfulness and other forms of practice are about seeing the truth of our connection to the world. That by coming down off this kazebama of I'm a self and I need to survive, coming down off that bama into present moment experiences, seeing the world phenomenologically as phenomena that come and go. This way we rejoin the truth of the world, which is made of phenomena that come and go. We return to the truth of the world, of relational truth. We are in relationship with the world, and everything is coming and going, including us. And therefore, we don't fight the world anymore, that is constantly changing, unpredictable and uncontrollable. We don't fight life anymore, which is constantly changing, unpredictable, uncontrollable. We ourselves realize that we are unpredictable, uncontrollable, a bunch of phenomena, changing constantly, without any solid, enduring thing inside. It will change. So our practice, mindfulness practice, actually, in looking at the Dharma in relational terms, is about rejoining the truth of the world through seeing it inside us. Because the Buddha also said, where do you see all of this? All I'm telling you is look in the body. Body, mind, that's the whole thing. You don't need to go anywhere else. What's happening here is good enough. So the basic instruction for mindfulness and meditation is, for example, see the body in the body. That means reduce identification, don't be busy with my body needs to be protected, I have to fight someone else that's threatening me, I have to be busy being comfortable. No, what is happening in the body, in the present moment? Look at it straight. Straight, four eyes, right at the body, as it is. And reducing the tendency to, be busy with the body about protecting it, about looking after it, about being more comfortable, about stopping life, about wanting things, about not wanting things. Just come down off all of that stuff. In the Buddhist tradition, mindfulness is always combined with another word called sampajana. And now I'm talking about the Buddhist tradition, I mean the canonical early Buddhist teachings, which at least from the Vipassana or Theravada community takes its authority largely from then. But of course there's many strains, as you know, that take its authority from all sorts of different places, but at least I can really only talk from the place of the Theravada or the canonical Dharma, because we take our authority from there largely. And the Buddha always joins sati with sampajana, and sati is mindfulness, and sampajana means clear understanding. So that mindfulness is not just being a machine for being awake to sensations, but actually drawing wisdom from that experience of being with sensations or being with phenomena of life. And the wisdom, for example, is the fact that every entity, every experience has a beginning and a middle and an end. And that watching the way things go by is wisdom, is a form of wisdom, is clearly understanding. Watching also the way things arise because of a condition that creates them. There is a certain condition, like stress in the body, and so you observe the experiences, sensations, and you feel there is contraction and it's producing unpleasant sensations in the body. Maybe my belly is contracted. So being aware of chains of experiences, conditions, creating results. That's another form, sampajana, another kind of understanding. So we try and develop understandings, not just to be mindful like a machine and seeing things, more being more sensitive. And thirdly, sampajana, it means also focusing on what is healthy for us. So mindfulness has quite a lot of values. It's not just being a machine, like you could say, a burglar that goes into a house and wants to steal is very mindful, they're very quiet, doesn't want to disturb the people sleeping and wants to steal, and is his mindfulness as good as anybody else's? In where we're mindful of the breath, so might as well be a burglar, and because he's doing very good practice, the burglar, in terms of mindfulness. So there is a concept in sampajana, there is this concept of wholesome, what is healthy for us, that there is an aspect of being healthy, not just to be a machine, mindful machine. So meditation is about an understanding of what is healthy, what is beneficial. And one of the things that's healthy for us is to be mindful of our vulnerability, pigiyut or shavririyut, that we are mindful of the fact that we are vulnerable and fragile, and it's okay, and we sit there, we can take pain, we sit there quietly, yes, it hurts, the back is hurting, but I'm there with it. That's a very, very important experience. It is in the direction of health, to be healthy, to be wholesome, to be with our experience rather than all the time fighting for the sake of comfort, to be more comfortable. So these were things we learn in the practice. As we do this, the mindfulness begins to reduce the mismatch, the ihatama, between a self and the changing, chaotic, moving world. And I read a book recently where a professor, doctor, was using mindfulness to treat OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And it was very interesting the way he moved from identification, where a person thinks that this handle of the door handle is dirty and is absolutely sure this is a fact. The door handle is dirty, it's got chaydakim, got bacteria, needs to be cleaned 100 times, to an understanding that there is a thought in the mind that the door handle is dirty. Okay. And there's another thought in the mind that the door handle is dirty. Okay. And there's another thought in the mind that the door handle is dirty. Okay. Here it is. It's a loop in the mind going round that the door, the handle, the yadid is dirty. So taking a sense of being mindful of your of what's going on in you, reducing the mismatch, that there's a world out there that's threatening, that's got things that I have to deal with, that I'm against or is against me. This movement of mindfulness in the world through the senses is what reconnects us again into the world from this sense of withdrawal. And I want to read Thich Nhat Hanh. He writes so beautifully about this process. And I want to read what he writes on penetration, the lakhdor, on observing inside of things. He says, when we want to understand something, we cannot just stand outside and observe it. We have to enter deeply into it and be one with it in order to really understand. If we want to understand a person, we have to feel their feelings, suffer their sufferings, and enjoy their joy. If we only look at the sheet of paper as an observer standing outside, we cannot understand it completely. We have to penetrate it. We have to be the cloud, be the sunshine, be the logger, the person cutting the wood, to make this sheet of paper. If we can enter it and be everything that is in it, our understanding of this sheet of paper will be perfect. There is an Indian story about a grain of salt that wanted to know just how salty the ocean is. So it jumped in and became one with the water of the ocean. In this way, the grain of salt gained perfect understanding. In the Sutra of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, where it talks a lot about sati and sampajana, the Buddha recommended that we observe in a penetrating way. He said we should contemplate the body in the body, the feelings in the feelings, the mental formations in the mental formations. Just like we did with the breath. Observe the breath in the breath. Not projections, not my breath, not a comfortable breath, uncomfortable, just what it is. Why did he use this kind of repetition? Because you have to enter in order to be one with what you want to observe. Nuclear scientists are beginning to say this too. When you enter the world of elementary particles, you have to become a participant in order to understand something. You can no longer stand and remain just an observer. Today, many scientists prefer the word participant to the word observer. And we should do the same. A couple who wish to understand each other have to be in the skin of their partner in order to feel. Otherwise, they cannot really understand. In the light of Buddhist meditation, love is impossible without understanding. You cannot love someone if you do not understand him or her. If you don't understand and you love, it's not love. It's something else. So, the process of Buddhist practice teaches us that this withdrawal and construction and closure, imprisoning in a self from which we observe the world out there, which is then usually threatening, difficult, problematic, and a struggle, we realize that the self construction in us is a cause of suffering, that we keep in the habit of being a self, of thinking from subject point of view and the world out there, that itself is painful. That's one of the constant realizations that we understand. The root of human suffering is this withdrawal, and looking at the world there. And secondly, that things are not really so, things are not really solid. If we look at ourselves, we see that the views we have about the world, such as I don't like that person, or I love that person, or I don't like, I have an enemy called them. The emotions, the confusions, the wounds we have, the pains we have, the pleasures we have, they're not really solid. They're not mutzak, they're not made of stone. And that we can clean them. And the Buddhist image here is cleaning stains on a cloth. That there is a cloth, and if we clean the stains, the cloth can take up, in the image in the suttas, the cloth can take up the color of the world. The world, we are the cloth, we want to take up the color of the world, but we can't because there's dirt on the cloth, stains, ktamim. So what we do is clean the cloth of taking all these issues seriously. Our views are this, what I need, my identity, my this, my that, what I believe, what I... The Buddha said, get out of all that stuff. Even beliefs. Don't believe in me. Don't believe in what I say. Don't believe in anything. It's a place with less protection, less defenses. Therefore, we're taking some risks. But this cleaning process of the stains on the cloth is what allows us to receive the world and be intimate. And now we're kind of coming to the issue of empathy and so on. There's a great meditation teacher that once was asked, Munindra, why do you meditate? He said, in order to see the tiny little flowers on the side of the path when I walk to the meditation hut every day. That's it. And that's about being with the world. How many times, I don't know if you know how, if all of you have been on retreat, but if you have, you will probably recognize to see people, maybe with doctorates, maybe professors, and maybe not, standing for like 15 minutes watching a line of ants walking along the path. Think, oh, are they crazy? What, watching ants walking along the path? It's like we come down into a place of connection, observing, knowing. In the center that we use for our retreats, there is a dog hospital in Indore, and it's right next to the meditation hall. There's a hospital for dogs, and sometimes the dogs are barking and in pain, and you feel the pain of them, and it's really a good lesson. Now, without meditation, I think 90% of the people there would come into the kibbutz, not pay attention. Oh, the dogs are making a noise. What a nuisance. They're disturbing. But with the perspective of the Dharma, things look very different. The dogs are our teacher. We begin to notice them. We notice each one. And people say how much they notice it, and they stand there listening to the dogs, and they listen to their cry, and they feel touched, and they feel empathy. And this is the movement, the awareness practice, reconnecting us to the world, creating intimacy, not just with my children or my body, but with the world itself. But it starts with the body, because you have to start somewhere. The intimacy you practice with what is available. Like the Buddha said, this two-meter-long body is good enough. That's where you start to learn intimacy instead of projections and so on. Story of the dogs reminds me that one time I was teaching a weekend near Jerusalem in a moshav, and the meditation room was right next to 10,000 chickens in a lull, who was so shouting and crying and complaining, and it was hard, really hot, and you could, they were just on non-stop. And some time I just couldn't just keep on like business as usual, and I started to cry, and I was in tears. And people said, what's the matter? Some terrible thing happened. And the people, the yogis, the people sitting, I said, no, listen to these chickens. Look at the pain out there. It's so painful to listen to them and their suffering. I'm sure if without the meditation practice, you just pass by lull. There's thousands of them and not pay any attention. So the bottom line is, empathy is released by letting go of the stains in the cloth. It's not that we really need to work hard to find empathy. And I think this is a message both from the Dharma and also from the research that Yulia brought. It's not that we have to somehow collect empathy and I should be a better person, and that's more of the same stuff of the self. Instead of that, just remove the obstructions, the blocks, the ihatama, the mismatch between me and the change. See the world in us, changing, moving, vulnerable, non-stable, non-selfing. Just see all that and see that that's the same stuff as the world is made of. So we're looking with the eyes of the world, at the world. Just seeing that happening here in our body, that creates the empathy, that releases empathy. So the model really would be that empathy is released if you clean the cloth, not that you have to somehow work hard to find it. And with that, of course, is a lot of realizations, a lot of understandings. And the one understanding that I wanted to point out to you, and it's from I suppose spiritual philosophers talk about a participatory universe, and I do like the term participation, and that in a sense the universe is a participatory universe. It's not that we are there looking out at the universe from a privileged place, sort of standing up from our privileged place looking there at the universe. There is a participatory universe. It's all participating, including all the pains and the joys. And of course, the image of the mirror is an important one here. That the metaphor of the mirror, we mirror the world mirrors us. We reflect the world. Our senses receive the world. We reflect the shakef at the world. And this sense of being a mirror or being a reflection is called right view in the Dharma. Right view is that we are participating together. There isn't a universe and a person looking out at the universe and generally finding it problematic. There is a participation and a flow between them, and in a deep way, according to the tradition or the canonic Buddhist tradition, what the Buddha discovered on the night of his enlightenment, as he reached the dawn, is this issue of the participatory universe, which in another Buddhist language you can call paticca samuppada, or the co-creation of everything, that everything is creating everything else, that there's no creator up there making the world. The world is created every moment. In the moment of seeing the world is created. The world and the observer create each other. Only we have to deal with the illusion that there is a self. But the Stephen Batchelor, and one of the many thinkers who work on this issue of self, and I'm not going into it, it's a wholly separate talk and it needs a huge amount of thinking and understanding. But one of the ways to that you can understand emptiness or non-self, not self, is transparency. That it's not that there's no such thing as self, because we experience selfing going on. The minute we open our eyes in the morning, the self comes up as soon as we are aware of anything at all. So the self is always appearing. So how do you understand non-self or emptiness? You can understand it as unfindability. You can't really find it. Or you can see the world, the transparency. You see the world through the self at the world. The self is not just a thing standing there that you can, you look at the world from the self. You see the world through the self. And so the self is transparent. But in the, and of course that, you know, in some way or other, all of that destroys the metaphor of mirror, because there really isn't, it's just a metaphor. There can't be a mirror if everything is transparent. The two don't go together. Aspaklaria Meira, I think in the Jewish tradition, Moshe was the only one who was enlightened and enough to be able to see that through the mirror at God. So the final piece I want to talk about is how we build behaviors from this understanding of the participatory universe. And the Buddhist ethics is really about behaviors that arise from this understanding. So Buddhist ethics really is not like Jewish ethics, in which the understanding is about what's needed to create a society that is sustainable, and there's no emphasis so much on Aserita Dibrot, the Ten Commandments of the Buddhist Ten Commandments. Basically, what happens is that as our understanding develops through this kind of practice of revealing a participatory universe, a relational world, so our behavior changes and our personality change. So we can come out of a view that enlightenment, which we all read about and we all hear about and we all, it's a big word and it's a, you know, huge thing, and enlightenment, coming out of the sense of enlightenment being an experience and something that we are as we are, going along, kind of schlepping along, until we get this thing called enlightenment that goes boom, and then we become someone different. But the teachings really are different. They say that as we touch again and again this sense of participatory universe, this sense of transparency of the self, this sense of dynamic changing world which is us and everything else, so our personality changes. And there are technical Buddhist ways of describing this. Perhaps the best way is the paramis, qualities of being, a kind of a awakened personality, qualities that replace the qualities of being a withdrawn person withdrawn from the world, the qualities that be often being insecurity, fear, neediness, loneliness, struggle, etc., replaced by other qualities such as generosity, calmness, stability and steadiness, fearlessness, honesty, patience. So there's a bunch of qualities that are actually growing. These qualities bring enlightenment, or are enlightened. So enlightenment is a change of the qualities of the human being based on, again and again, the practice of view, a different way of looking at the world and us, this ending of the mismatch, the ihatama. That understanding creates a different person, slowly. An example of generosity, where an ethics based on laws would say you have to give. It's important to give. But generosity as a change in personality or in a parami would say, would go from there to, okay, go from have to give to it's good to give. Go from it's good to give, to be generous, to it's joyful to give. Because it makes everybody happy. That's already, the joy of giving is already part of participatory universe. Because you enjoy, you give to others, you see their pleasure. You get, like the Dalai Lama said, it's so much more joyful to give to others than just to have for yourself, because there's more of them. It's a beautiful way of describing. So that's already, if you see generosity not as a rule, but as a joyful act that makes others and yourself joyful, it's already breaking down barriers of self and the world. But it goes further. Generosity is not about me and others. It's about participation. That we give because we are participating. We give because there's flow. That holding on to things myself, this holding is about the self that basically doesn't exist. It's an illusion of withdrawal, of having me against the world. So the giving is an expression of participating in the world and is built on an understanding of everything giving to everything else. Giving and taking being one thing. That the tree gives to the earth gives to the tree, the person gives, you know, there's something fundamental of giving a flow which, when seen, makes generosity a spiritual practice or a spiritual act. And even deeper in a sense is an understanding, again, from the participatory world, that it's easy to give because you don't really own it in the first place. Because if there's no real enduring self, who owns anything? Do you say you can own anything? Again, when ownership itself is an act of separation. Do I own my house? Do I own my car? Do I own the land? Because there's a piece of paper in the tabu that says this is your land. Do you own it? I can take it with me to the next world. I mean, owning is a theory in the mind, but it's not in reality. So no ownership, including of the body, is part of a parami or understanding which leads to a different person, namely a person deeply generous. So Buddhist ethics are based on this relational model, are based on relational world and not on principles. Because of that, for example, again, I can't go into this, we can have lots of discussion another time, but Buddha wasn't a pacifist, and Buddhists are not necessarily pacifists, because pacifism is a view and a principle called pacifism, and the Buddha said no, experience a relational world and you will not want to harm anybody. You can't harm people if you and them are one. If you're with, in empathy, others in relational world, that's the best way not to harm people. Not because someone says don't harm. And a couple of texts here. The most classical texts that describe the most well-known Buddhist short piece that describes this understanding as a basis of morality or ethics is in the Dhammapada, a kind of condensation of small quotations from great variety of Buddhist texts. And I have it here in Hebrew, so maybe someone would you like to read it for me? It's from there to there.
כל הברואים אוהדים מול אלימות. כולם יראים את המוות, כולם אוהבים את החיים. ראה את עצמך באחרים, במי אם כך תוכל לפגוע? איזו רעה תוכל לעשות? זה המחפש אושר על ידי פגיעה באחרים המחפשים אושר, לא ימצא אושר לעולם. מפני שאחיך כמוך הוא, הוא רוצה להיות מאושר, אל תראה לו לעולם, וכאשר תעזוב חיים אלה, תמצא אושר גם אתה.
That's in a word the fundamentals of Buddhist ethics. Just in a word, that's it. And it needs work on it, but you can see how that comes from this relational, empathic world of true story that I heard about an abbot, head of a monastery, that was giving a talk. And one of the monks came to him and said, your tea, there's a fly that just fell into the tea. Can I deal with it? Can I take your tea and deal with it? And the abbot said, sure, sure. So the monk went out with the tea cup, with the fly inside the tea, outside, brought back a cup of tea without the fly and said, I think he'll be all right now. And because we're talking about flies, I found a beautiful poem which I like, because one of my favorite authors is William Blake, and I've really enjoyed William Blake since I was in the 60s before. Little fly, your summer's play, the play in the summer, your summer's play, my thoughtless hand has brushed away. Am not I a fly like thee, or art not you a man like me? For I dance and drink and sing, till some blind hand shall brush my wing. So that's more or less what I want to say. The subject of ethics is so big that I don't quite know really how to go into it, but I would suggest that we have it as a kind of background program in our thoughts this afternoon and in our discussion. So we're going to have a group discussion, but that the ethical issue follows right behind the issue of empathy and relational world. Like, it's right behind there that we can't think about empathy in a kind of dry way. We have to think how we are and how we would be in this empathic place, because it's so much fundamental to everything that we're talking about. And so much basis to also the spiritual life. There isn't such a thing as mindfulness, as I tried to say, as a meditation practice, as a spiritual practice, without ethical foundations. It just doesn't work. As I say in the tradition, it's like trying to row a boat which is tied to the bank. It just doesn't go anywhere unless the ethical ground is strong. The boat doesn't go anywhere. And to finish, I'll read another poem that I enjoy, also about ethics. Don't kill a snake in front of the eyes of a saint, for the saint's being includes all living things, and therefore he's easily hurt. A single hair taken from your body causes instant pain. The person that perceives life as a community always suffers. To those who equate their being with everything, even the other is a sensation of yourself. Biduk, what we heard. Says Tuka, the poet, I give you the root of ethics. Be happy to worship the ground of all being in your own being. So let's just take a moment of just reflection, silent, just to absorb it, and then maybe we have time, we'll have a few questions and we'll carry on.